A couple of really important parts of this, I think, are that we are now describing in really specific terms what's expected in that risk assessment process, that we've laid out and introduced certain comments through our interim standards and auditing standard number 5. Now we're establishing a process that auditors are required to go through to, in fact, support their risk assessment that they've made and to make a more thorough evaluation of the risks that they've identified, and then to more explicitly require them to link their responses and tailor their audit procedures and the overall conduct of their audit to address those, and to make a more thorough and complete and objective evaluation of the results of their work. In essence, it boils down to, at least on the front end and the back end, connecting the dots. On the front end, doing more work to think about risks and on the back end, to do a more complete scan of both the positive and the negative evidence. How it might affect a given firm, of course, is going to depend on how they've approached their risk-based process in the past. I would expect that there will be, because there are more requirements related to the risk assessment process, there'll be more incremental effort involved in that as compared to certainly our existing standards. I think that'll be offset somewhat by hopefully they will be able to have now, the result will be a sharper focus on their actual test work in controls and financial statement accounts and disclosures, so that may tend to offset somewhat the incremental effort. And of course, if for firms that may have been taking a minimalist approach to risk assessment in the past and assessing risk without essentially doing their homework, then it's going to be a much more significant change for them.
Okay, well, you've described what you think would be some significant effects. I assume those would also have documentation consequences. What do you think the impact on audit costs is going to be? Could you refer to offsetting impacts on testing? How does that all balance?
Right. I think when I'm talking about incremental effort, I think there'll be more incremental effort on the front end in terms of incremental cost, if you will, on the front side investment in the risk assessment portion of the audit, which hopefully will be offset at least in part by better, more effective testing of the accounts and control.
I think there certainly are more requirements in these standards that exist today, and the effect of more requirements would be some additional audit effort. I think, as Keith has said, the standards set forth a process that is a very logical process for assessing risk, addressing risk, and evaluating those results. Done properly, it really focuses the auditor on the right risk and the right attention on that. And I think, as he said, that right focus could offset the way in which an audit is done, such that the cost would increase significantly. But it likely would have some increase in cost. Again, that's going to vary based upon the approach of any particular firm.
Well, maybe along those lines then, is this an area where you think there'll be a significantly differential effect on small firms versus large firms? I think you made some comments about the scalability of the standards. Nonetheless, is this something that's going to impact small firms?
We looked at that very significantly. I mean, spent a lot of time thinking about how to make these standards scalable. And certainly the expectation is going to be, again, it's going to scale based on the size and the complexity of a company. Certainly a larger, more complex company, there's going to be a lot more work involved in understanding the nature of the company, understanding the relevant risks that are present. A smaller, less complex company, I don't think will require nearly as much effort in terms of doing the homework to understand what the risks are present. The other thing that we paid special attention to, somewhat related to that, is in the area of testing controls, because in the smaller companies, the non-accelerated filers, for example, wouldn't have the internal control audit requirement. So we've been careful to preserve the same flexibility that they've had in the past about when to test controls that they've had under existence.
You know, I do think this is something we need to keep in mind, and perhaps at our small business forums we can kind of work face-to-face with smaller firms to make sure that they understand what we're trying to get at here and that there aren't unnecessary problems in implementation.
We agree with that point 100%, and our next step would be to develop a program to be presented at the small business forums, particularly aimed at the smaller firms, and how these risk assessment standards work.
Good. Well, let me ask you another question that kind of plays off the idea of these standards being foundational. I think these are certainly the most extensive set of changes we've made at one time to the interim auditing standards. Well, now, if the vote goes the way you hope it will, and I'll be up to having issued 15 auditing standards superseding significant parts of the interim standards. Several commenters mentioned a point that I think I've been concerned about for some time. To me, all this makes it harder and harder to understand what the auditing requirements are, because you've got interim standards codified, partially superseded, and then a set of separate pronouncements that we've issued, and nothing that really brings those all together in one framework. Do we have a plan to codify our standards? And where does that stand? I could ask first, what's your reaction to whether it's getting harder and harder to understand what the auditing literature is because of the way we're operating?
I think your question is a very good one, and the point that was made by commenters in this regard is a very good one as well. This is a tough issue for us. On the one hand, we certainly would like to begin a process of codification of the standards. But we have standards that look very different. The look of the new 15 standards with their objectives and very specific requirements is quite different than the look of the interim standards that don't have objectives and frequently have much more discussion and general discussion around an issue rather than specific requirements. So simply codifying them as they exist today would be sort of codifying a little bit of apples and pears, and thus may not be that helpful. On the other hand, trying to do such a codification would still require certain exposure because we'd be changing references, et cetera. And I think in doing that, we'd be opening up the standards and for comment, and I think people would comment on areas where the interim standards need to be replaced. So it's an important issue. We're thinking about it. But let me just expand on this a little bit further. I think this issue is, and it probably goes to something that board member Charlie Niemeyer mentioned. There's a number of things that we would like to have attacked at the same time. The board spent a lot of time in its early years on internal control over financial reporting. Another approach, if we hadn't had to deal with that, would have been to deal with all of the interim standards at once and publish all new standards together, much as the IAASC did in their Clarity project. Having spent so much time on internal control over financial reporting, I think I feel that we were instructed to start dealing with these standards one by one on a priority-based approach and fix the interim standards, and that therefore we didn't have the luxury of doing it all at once. So we've been dealing with these on a priority basis, looking at things as these standards, confirmations, other areas where we think needed improvement right away. We have the standards that Charlie Niemeyer mentioned, use of other auditors and use of specialists, very high on our agenda to be dealt with next. So we're trying to deal with the standards, to revise interim standards, to put out new standards where we really think it's necessary, and I think that's taking a priority over the codification approach. But having said that, codification is on our list to think about how to approach this.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate all that, and I understand all that. I don't disagree with anything you said. Codification is somewhere in our future. It's just going to become inevitable. And
yeah.
I also appreciate that it would be a massive project. But I think we're going to need to develop this is an overused word, but a roadmap as to how we're going to get to codification. Let me ask you about something else. I mean, you made, I thought, Marty, a very eloquent and persuasive statement about how these standards integrate consideration of fraud throughout the audit planning execution process and how important that is. I did want to note and ask you to comment that there is a contrary view, and we received a number of comments that noted that today we have one standard on auditor consideration of the risk of fraud, AU 316. We are taking significant parts, the most important parts, out of AU 316, and because they'll now be addressed in other parts of other standards, leaving something in AU 316. So there will no longer be a comprehensive fraud consideration standard. And one of the large firms said, I thought somewhat ominously in their comments, "We do not believe that auditor performance will be improved by spreading fraud-related requirements throughout the standards." I know you addressed this from a little different angle at the beginning, but I wonder if you could comment on that concern that we're losing something by not having a single fraud standard.
I'll start on that and then maybe ask Keith to join in. There were clearly two different points of view on this issue. But I think at the end of the day, we were most influenced by inspection findings in this regard. And inspection findings demonstrated that far too often, fraud was an isolated event that took place maybe sometime at the beginning, fraud considerations in the beginning of the audit, and then didn't get tied in later on to audit risk assessments, to audit procedures, to audit findings, and the evaluation of results. And so, rather than having fraud consideration be a one-time, let's think about a process, let's get it over with, these standards really require the auditor to think about fraud throughout the audit process, in the planning process, in the assessment of risk, in the evaluation of audit results, and pulling together audit evidence. So we think it's going to be far more effective as auditors think about fraud throughout an audit and not just at one time. There's still quite a bit left in AU 316, and maybe Keith can comment on the fact that while we did build fraud concepts throughout the risk assessment standards and therefore throughout the audit process, there's quite a bit left with respect to the consideration of fraud in 316, and maybe you can touch on that.
AU 316, the way we've amended it, it's still going to have most of the general discussion of what the fraud, how fraud affects the financial statements, and it's going to talk about more detailed matters, such as it's going to retain the discussion and examples of fraud risk factors, and it's going to have some of the more detailed procedures that are performed to respond to fraud, like journal entry testing and evaluation of management bias and estimates, some specific procedures related to that. And also looking at significant unusual transactions. And one of the things we're doing through amendment is replacing some of the discussion in there with something of a roadmap that will help the reader of the amended AU 316 know where to go to look at these other relevant portions. Where do you go to find out the procedures for identifying and assessing fraud risk? And where do you go to find out the procedures for responding to fraud risk? So There'll still be some useful tools to aid the reader in trying to go and do more of that. But I think our view was, in looking at this carefully and considering what we've seen, is that much of this process we've established for assessing risk and identifying risk uncovers a lot of risk factors, declining economic conditions or complex financial processes that could simultaneously present risks of errors or fraud. So it's really important, I think, for the standards to communicate that this process, you go through and obtain this understanding and do this foundational work, and then that informs your risk of both fraud and errors. And that carries forward throughout these risk assessment standards.
Okay, well, thanks for all that. And we do have, as you noted, Marty, the luxury of an inspection process. We've seen problems in this area, largely boiling down to people simply not following the procedures or applying the procedures in AU 316, and I think it is important that we look to see how practice changes under this standard, and if that suggests the need for further revisions in this area, then be open to them. But,
right.
We'll continue to consider. Well, first of all, we do think this will make improvements in the assessment of fraud risk, but we'll continue to monitor how it's implemented, but also think about other ways in which we should deal with the fraud standards.
There's been some discussion already of the problem of use of other auditors in multi-location audits. I think you said, Keith, that AS number 9 had been amended to didn't copy down your full quote, but something about to explain specifically what the responsibilities were in that area. I wonder if you could elaborate on what you feel has been done to AS9 in order to address this problem. And I certainly feel like there's a long way to go in getting a handle on the whole problem of use of other auditors. But why don't you start with what you feel we've done so far?
Right, and it's helpful to step back and look a little bit about what the planning standard was intended to accomplish. The provisions of AS9 that relate to multi-location are really around trying to determine an appropriate scope for testing in a multi-location environment. So the overarching principle is the more risk in the location, the more audit attention that location needs. And that plays out in two respects. One is in the selection of the locations for testing, and the other is what you do in those selected locations. And the language that we used in the reproposed standard sort of blended those two aspects of the scoping together. And so what we did was try to explain a little bit more precisely what we had in mind, and especially for those situations where you had other auditors involved, recognizing that we have an active project on use of other auditors. We weren't attempting to change those requirements specifically here, but what we were doing was making clear that you still have to use this risk process. You have to look at the risk factors in the standard to assess the risks at the individual locations, and that affects your selection for testing. But if that location, that subsidiary business unit, has been it. Needs to be tested because of the risks, then, and it's being audited by another auditor that's covered by AU-543, then you look at AU-543 to determine how much work or what kind of work you need to do with respect to using that work of the other auditor.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I think it's, we can comment, I think it's fair to say that nothing we've done here in AS9 or for that matter in AS10 really is designed to get at the heart of the kinds of problems that are outlined in the practice order from a couple weeks ago, which essentially deals with situations where people are using auditors in other jurisdictions under circumstances where it wouldn't appear that they could possibly be participating in the planning of the work effectively or supervising the work effectively and probably not evaluating the work effectively. But that is a project, and it may... I'll give you the answer to the question. You can tell me if I'm right, but that might lead to changes in 9 and 10 as we're adopting them.
Well, so the first part of your comment, Practice Alert 6 did point out the issues that you raised, that there are problems in how auditors are working with other auditors and whether they were either supervising them under 311 or whether they were considering them other auditors and fulfilling responsibilities under 543. In some cases, they weren't doing either. And so both Practice Alert 6 and these standards make clear that the auditor either has to be supervising the other auditors or following 543 and then working with other auditors in that regard. But with respect to the rest of it, we agree 100%. Two critically important projects are the use of specialists and supervising specialists and the use of other auditors and supervising the other auditors who participate in the audit. And those standards setting projects are highest on our list to deal with, and we think there will be significant changes in both of those areas. There will be significant changes. AS10 is the foundation for supervision. Whether the supervision standard itself has to be changed, we'll see based upon the work we do on those two other areas. Clearly, supervision of specialists and supervision of other auditors will change, but that will largely be reflected in those other standards. how it integrates and how we change it, and we'll see as we pull it together.
Hey, let me just ask you quickly about two other things, and then I'll surrender the floor here. The next item on the board's agenda is an interpretive release on failure to supervise and how we might use our enforcement authority to sanction failures to supervise. Most of what, audience item number 10 is about supervision, and most of what it's about is the responsibilities of the engagement partner to supervise the engagement team and other aspects of the engagement. Do you see a connection between those two projects, the failure to supervise release and these standards, particularly AS10? If so, what's the connection?
Well, you've laid out part of it already. AS10 is really focused on the engagement partner and the people in other people in the engagement team that assist the engagement partner with the supervision of the conduct of the engagement team on a given audit. So it's mostly about the engagement team's work on a given audit. And my understanding, and I've looked to general counsel to clarify that the failure to supervise release is broader than the scope of AS10.
Yeah, just to add to what Keith said, that's correct. And to be clear, the two different items for the boards today are not dependent on each other in any sense. It's largely coincidental, I think, that both are being considered on the same day. At the same time, as I think Keith said, a violation of the new standard, AS10 on supervision, could be the basis for a board action under this failure to supervise provision in the Act. Of course, at the same time, that's also true of AS10's predecessor, AU311, and as Keith did say, it's also the case that the failure to supervise provision, as we'll get into in a few minutes, is broader and could apply both to the engagement partner and other situations apart from specific violations of AS10, and also has potential application to other supervisory personnel within an accounting firm.
Okay, well, thanks for that. I mean, as you say, we will get into failure to supervise in just a minute. Just the last thing I want to ask you to comment on. And one of the things we've been trying to do in these standards in the last year or so is to give people a comparison of what we're doing to the ISAs so that they can understand the similarities and differences, and I think that's important. When we put the re-proposal out for comment, which did include a comparison, GAO commented on it. It was Appendix 10 in the re-proposal, and they said we find its usefulness limited by inadequate explanations of, one, the reasons for differences between the new proposed PCOB standards and international standards, and two, the changes in practice that are expected to result from these differences. Appendix 10 is now morphed into Appendix 11 in the current version. Have you tried to address those comments, or what's your reaction to those?
Well, I guess this has been an area that we've received feedback from commenters throughout this process, beginning with the original proposal when we first tried this approach, and we've consistently received feedback, suggestions for improvement. What we've tried to do this time, I think, it's very important to have one place for readers to go to understand what the requirements are, to have the board's explanation of the requirements in the standard. And so we have an appendix 10 that deals with that, deals with how we've responded to comments, those kinds of very important parts of information to understand what our standards say. Then what we've tried to do is put a little bit more structure around the organization of that appendix. And then Appendix 11 is somewhat supplemental to Appendix 10. It talks specifically about comparing the standards of the IAASB and the ASB to these standards. And so what we've done is tried to add a little bit more language in that comparison document to highlight where there are points of difference and then reference them back into Appendix 10, where we talk about the board's rationale for why it did what it did in respect to the standards. So it should be easier for someone who's using the document to be able to identify not only what the differences are, but what the rationale was for the differences.
think that's an improvement. At the same time, though, we try not to interpret how somebody might apply the IAAFD standards, the ISAs. And so the comparison is limited in that regard, in the sense that we point out what our requirements are that are different than and above the ISA requirements, without trying to interpret how somebody may be applying the ISA standards at the same time. So it is adding this appendix, I think, is helpful. May not answer everybody's questions, though, at all, in all cases, and we'll continue to try to improve what we do this.
Okay, thank you. Well, let me ask the other members of the board if they have any further comments or questions or other items on this matter. Mr. Niemeyer.
As I've said, I do support these standards, but my support is certainly dependent upon this idea that we will be looking at the supervision area, and particularly the areas related to specialists and other auditors. I don't know how much detail we need to get here into the table, but I have to say I can't really envision addressing those adequately without revisiting auditing center number 10. And so I just want to make sure, just the way things sort of were set at the table here, I just want to make sure that we do have a commitment that we're going to be looking at AS-10, and, it will be as a part of that project, and if revisions are required, that they would be made.
There is a commitment, absolutely, to look at, first of all, use the specialists and have them supervised, and using other auditors and have them supervised, and to make significant changes there. To the extent that requires changes in AS-10, we'll make them.
Thank you.
And as I said, I appreciate your focus on fraud in these standards. I think the consideration of fraud risk permeates the standards, and I think that's a very positive contribution. I also, as I indicated in my statement, in terms of the differences of standards between the interim standards and the international standards, to the extent that you can, I know you're making considerable progress on this. If you would clearly differentiate as you see fit how we further protect investors based upon our standards, I think that would be very helpful. But thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. If there's no further discussion, then I'll put the question to a vote. All those in favor of approving the motion and thereby approving these standards, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? There's nobody left to say no. The ayes have it. The motion is carried unanimously. Our second item on the agenda today is a staff recommendation to issue a release on the provision in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act authorizing the board to impose disciplinary sanctions for failure to supervise an associated person of a registered accounting firm. We will now turn to Michael Stevenson, Deputy General Counsel, and Bella Rivshin, Associate Chief Auditor, for this recommendation. Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you. Good morning. In the discussion on the standards that the board has just adopted, there was focus on the role that supervision plays in achieving quality audits that benefit investors. That discussion focused on a particular audit standard that prescribes supervision responsibilities for certain individuals. But the quality of a firm's audit practice is directly affected by the quality of supervision throughout the firm. Supervision responsibilities rooted in the board's auditing standards and quality control standards are carried out by individuals at all levels within a firm. We'd like to now turn your attention to a supervision-related issue that addresses those broader supervision issues. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act includes a provision that authorizes the board to impose sanctions on a firm or any of its supervisory persons in cases where the firm has failed reasonably to supervise an associated person of the firm who has committed a violation of laws, rules, or standards within the board's enforcement jurisdiction. And it authorizes the board to do so without regard to whether the supervisory conduct violated any specific rule or standard. That authority is found in Section 105(c)(6) of the Act. We're recommending today that the board issue a release that discusses that Section 105(c)(6) authority. The release would serve two purposes. First, Part 1 of the release is intended to highlight the scope of Section 105(c)(6)'s application. we see some value in doing this, in part because the scope may be a little different than a casual observer might assume, just from being generally aware that there's a failure to supervise provision in the law. For example, one might make an assumption that the sanctioning authority relates only to persons on an engagement team, or that persons could be sanctioned only for violating specific supervision rules that directly govern their conduct. Neither of those assumptions is correct. Our thought behind the release, part one of the release, is that drawing some attention to the scope might be helpful to firms and associated persons and might by itself prompt improved supervision practices. Part one, I want to emphasize that part one should not be understood as a proposal. Part one does not modify any existing legal requirements, create new legal requirements, or constitute a rule of the board. And any specific application of 105C6, of course, would occur in a context where a respondent could contest the board's view of the scope of 105C6 and ultimately get review of any dispute by the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Court of Appeals. So part one should not be understood as a proposal, and the release is not inviting comment on part one. In contrast, and separately, part two of the release describes and invites comments on concepts for rules that, without imposing any new supervision responsibilities in auditing standards or quality control standards, would require firms to make and document clear assignments of the supervision responsibilities that are already required to be part of a firm's audit practice. Such rules might serve to further the public interest and protect investors by increasing clarity about who within the firm is accountable for various responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audits. The release that we're recommending is not a long document. The discussion of the scope of Section 105C6 is about 7 pages, and the discussion of the rule or standard concepts is about 4 pages. I'll provide a brief overview of the points relating to the scope of Section 105C6, and Bella Rivshin from the Office of the Chief Auditor will discuss the rule concepts. Section 105C6 provides that the board may impose sanctions on a registered firm or what the Act refers to as a supervisory person of such firm if an associated person of the firm commits certain violations and the firm has failed reasonably to supervise that associated person, either as required by the rules of the board relating to auditing or quality control standards, or otherwise, with a view to preventing such violations. The release focuses on the distinction between what it refers to as the rules clause, that is, the provision about failing to supervise someone as required by the rules of the board relating to auditing or quality control standards, and what it refers to as the or otherwise clause. In isolation, the rules clause of Section 105C6 would be essentially redundant of authority provided to the board elsewhere in the Act. That is, to the extent the board adopts rules or standards related to supervision, the sanctioning authority provided by the rules clause overlaps significantly with the broad authority the board has to impose sanctions for any violation of rules or standards. In fact, without invoking Section 105C6, the board has previously exercised its authority to impose sanctions against the firm for violation of the standard related to supervision. On the other hand, the range of conduct that the board might address through the or otherwise clause necessarily encompasses conduct not covered by any supervision rules or standards. For conduct in that category, the board's authority to impose sanctions is found only in Section 105C6. And necessarily involves case-by-case determinations concerning the reasonableness of supervision in particular circumstances, without regard to whether any specific rules or standards relating to supervision are implicated. Section 105C6 is inherently open-ended on this point, and in that respect, is similar to the provisions of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 that authorized the Commission to impose sanctions against broker-dealers and their associated persons for failure to supervise. In fact, the legislative history in Section 105C6 makes clear that 105C6 is modeled on the Exchange Act provisions. Against that background, the release discusses two aspects of the scope of Section 105(c)(6). First, in providing that the board may impose sanctions on a firm or upon a supervisory person of a firm, how, if at all, does it limit the universe of associated persons whom the board may sanction for failure to supervise? Second, what areas of responsibility should be understood as involving responsibility to supervise in the sense that makes the conduct reachable through Section 105(c)(6). As to the first question, the release notes that nothing in Section 105(c)(6) indicates that the term supervisory person limits that section's reach to those with direct and immediate supervisory responsibility for the associated person who commits the violation. Any associated person in the firm, including even the most senior personnel of very large firms, could be a supervisory person for Section 105(c)(6) purposes, depending upon the nature of their responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to the conduct of the associated person who commits the underlying violation. That said, it does not follow that each person with such responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to a particular violation could be sanctioned merely because the violation occurred, absent a finding that the supervisor failed to reasonably supervise the associated person. The release describes the board's view that Section 105(c)(6) sanctions would be appropriate only where, in relation to the predicate violation, there has been a failure to exercise such responsibility, ability, or authority reasonably. Turning to the second question, what areas of responsibility are within the scope of supervision for purposes of the or otherwise clause of Section 105(c)(6), the release describes that supervision responsibilities are rooted not only in auditing standards like AS-10 and its predecessor AU-311, but also in the board's quality control standards. The introduction to the quality control standards notes that they relate to quality control procedures to ensure that services are competently delivered and adequately supervised. Those standards broadly define a system of quality control as a process to provide the firm with reasonable assurance that its personnel comply with applicable professional standards and the firm's standards of quality. QC standards include, among other things, a section on monitoring a firm's audit practice, and a section on a firm's responsibility related to staffing audits, in particular the firm's responsibilities concerning the competencies of the person in charge of an audit. The release explains that associated persons who have responsibility related to a firm's implementation of those quality control standards, whether broadly or with respect to only a portion of the firm's audit practice, have responsibilities that, depending on the facts and circumstances, could be understood as supervision responsibilities in relation to an individual associated person. But let me briefly provide one concrete example that's discussed in the release. The quality control standards address the need for a firm to have policies and procedures to provide reasonable assurance that the firm will staff audits with personnel, including engagement partners, who have the technical proficiency and competency necessary for the particular audit. If a violation occurs in a particular audit because, for example, the engagement partner lacked the necessary proficiency and competency, an associated person of the firm who had unreasonably carried out responsibility in relation to staffing that audit with that partner could, depending upon the facts and circumstances, be sanctioned under Section 105(c)(6) for failure reasonably to supervise. It's important to note that this does not mean that the supervisory conduct would be viewed as necessarily unreasonable just because of the engagement partner's violation. It's merely to say that such conduct could be understood under the facts and circumstances as involving supervision of the associated person, and unreasonable conduct in that context could therefore lead to sanctions under Section 105(c)(6). Said another way, Section 105(c)(6) does not create a form of strict failure to supervise liability for the firm or supervisory persons just because an associated person has committed a violation. In fact, Section 105(c)(6)(b) provides the possibility of an affirmative defense that would preclude the board from imposing sanctions against the supervisory person for failure to supervise if three conditions are satisfied. those conditions are that the individual that's reasonably discharged the supervisory duties placed on him or her by the firm's procedures. Second, that the individual had no reasonable cause to believe that the firm's procedures were not being complied with. And third, that the firm's procedures comply with applicable board rules and would reasonably be expected to prevent and detect the violation. As the release describes, a respondent who seeks to rely on the affirmative defense in Section 105C6B could bear the burden of raising it and establishing that all three elements are satisfied. That is a brief overview of the discussion in Part 1 of the release, the scope of Section 105C6. Before I turn it over to Bella to discuss the separate part of the release relating to possible rules to complement the application of 105C6, I'd like to acknowledge the important contributions made to the release, not only by Bella, but also by Chris David in the Office of the Chief Auditor, by Carol Yanofsky, my colleague in the Office of General Counsel, and by Claudius Modesti and Mark Caprellian in the Division of Enforcement. Bella?
Thank you, Michael. Mr. Chairman and members of the board, I would now like to focus on Part 2 of the release and recommend that the board issue for public comment a concept release on specific rulemaking concepts that would require firms to make and document clear assignments of the supervision responsibilities that are already required to be part of any audit practice. The staff is interested in obtaining feedback on whether such potential rules would further serve to further the public interest and protect investors by increasing the clarity about who within the firm is accountable for various responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audit. I would like to specifically note that the concept release and any subsequent rulemaking is not intended to amend the auditing standard the board just adopted a few minutes ago, supervision AS10, and is not intended to impose any new supervision responsibilities in the board's other auditing standards and quality control standards. The PCUB staff, through inspections and investigations at times, have observed that the quality of supervision within a firm was affected by the lack of clarity regarding the allocation of various supervisory responsibilities at different levels within the firm's practice. The staff believes that rules requiring firms to make and document clear assignments of responsibility for implementing the necessary quality control policies and procedures could help avoid potential confusion within a firm about where significant responsibility rests, confusion that could potentially lead to gaps in supervision with consequent violations of professional standards. In addition, the staff believes that such rules could facilitate the PCOB's assessment through the inspection process of a firm's supervisory practices. The potential rules could also facilitate identifying, after a predicate violation has occurred, the persons with relevant supervision responsibilities. I want to emphasize that the types of rules the staff is considering would not create the new supervision responsibilities, but would only address how clearly the firms assign responsibilities that are already required to be part of the audit practice. The potential rulemaking would be in addition to the board's current quality control standards. The release would seek comments on how the accounting firms currently execute the clear assignments of supervisory responsibility and the level of documentation that exists of the firm's policies. The staff is particularly interested in hearing from firms of varying sizes their views about their structures and existing quality control practices. Additionally, the staff is interested in hearing how investors, audit committees, and others who rely on audited financial statements view the importance of clearly defined and documented supervisory responsibilities at accounting firms. The staff in the release has also preliminarily considered how such a rule might be crafted. The release outlines two potential approaches, a general and a more detailed approach. One possibility is to formulate a rule that only in general terms requires assignment of responsibility and documentation of that assignment. Under this approach, a rule could build on the existing requirement that responsibility for the design and implementation of quality control policies and procedures be assigned to appropriate individuals and could require firms to document such specific assignments sufficient to cover the full range of the firm's obligations under the board's quality control standards. In other words, if a firm complied with its rules, it could be possible to identify with respect to a particular violation in an audit any individual who had responsibility for any aspect of the quality control system that failed and identify other individuals with supervisory responsibility for those individuals' performance relating to the quality control system. Another approach could involve a more detailed formulation. Under this approach, a rule could identify and define various specific areas of supervisory responsibility and could require a firm to assign responsibility in each area specifically identified to specifically identified individuals. The areas of supervisory responsibility identified in a more detailed approach could be derived from the quality control standards. The potential benefit of a more detailed approach would not be to encompass more or different areas of supervisory responsibility than the general approach, but would just be to make more concrete the scope of the rule's requirement and so reduce the risk posed by the general approach, that a firm might think that it has covered the relevant range of responsibilities, only to have the board identify a gap in the firm's assignment. The staff believes that a firm could have some flexibility in aspects of how it approaches compliance with a potential rule under either potential approach. The release would also seek comment on possible approaches to such an assignment rule, including any advantages or disadvantages, and would also seek comment on a degree of detail that would be appropriate to include in a potential rule. In summary, the staff recommend that the board issue a concept release to solicit public comment for a 90-day period on conceptual approaches to rulemaking that might complement the application of Section 105(c)(6) and through increased accountability lead to improved supervision practices and consequently improve audit quality. We would be pleased to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson and Ms. Rushin. Let me ask the other board members if there are any motions concerning the failure to supervise release that's been described.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Mr. Niemeyer.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board instruct the staff to issue the release no failure to supervise, as recommended, for public comment for a period of 90 days.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I second.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Let me make some comments about this release.